300 Quaker, problem with
5-2.
Okay, I'm on the northbound access. Just right at the light.
If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/ganglandwire. Follow true crime storyteller Gary Jenkins on Twitter at Jenks Law. Buy the DVD Gangland Wire or download the Kansas City Mob Tour app. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Good evening, folks. We're back here in the beautiful studios of the Big Dumb Fun Show. I'm here with my good friend and co-host, Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
Well, folks, tonight we have a special guest for you and an expert on mob influence over casinos. You know, Kansas City became famous for mob influence over casinos. We were our local FBI and our local intelligence unit, which I was a part of back in those days, helped expose the Teamsters' connection with the four major crime families here in the Midwest, the Milwaukee, Cleveland, Chicago, and Kansas City families, and actually recorded them talking about how they steal from casinos. And by the end of that investigation, which was titled The Straw Man, they had a big trial here in Kansas City, and they put the heads of those four mob families in jail and really irrevocably altered Midwest organized crime. I'm not sure how much effect it had back east, but sure altered the Midwest organized crime families. So anyhow, we've got Bill here.
Well, and if you actually listen to the intro for Gangland Wire Crime Stories, there's some of those clips. There's some effect noise of the police and stuff, but some of that actual wiretap conversation that I clipped out and put into that intro of these guys talking about setting up a bank because, you know, rolling $3,000 in cash is easy, but $3,000 in coins from the slots, you're just not going to walk out of the casino.
Yeah, that was actually Carl Thomas and Nick Savella talking about that. But more about that later. We've got Bill on the line. Bill, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Well, you know, you have written a couple of books, and the most recent one you sent me, 30 Illegal Years to the Strip, which is a very well-written and very detailed story of mob influence, illegal gambling, and how they ended up running all the casinos in Las Vegas. And you told me on the phone the other day, we were talking about this, a really interesting little tidbit, and that was that when the local people started trying to run casinos out in Las Vegas, they couldn't do it. And who did they turn to for help? And who knew how to run gaming casinos at that point in time? It was the mob. They were the only ones that knew how to do it. That's really the reason that Las Vegas even kind of survived when they first got into gambling, and the reason they thrived was because of mob expertise in running gaming.
Yes, when Nevada legalized gambling, they of course had no homegrown industry to draw from. So for many years, whenever a new hotel or would open or a casino would make a major expansion, they would have to draw from the illegal casinos across the United States for executives and dealers because they had no developmental program in-house. And when I started dealing in 1965, most of the guys in the pit behind me, the executives, had come out of illegal gambling and spent many years in it.
Now, Bill, your background, you said in 1965 you were a dealer at what casino in Las Vegas?
I started at Lake Tahoe the day the Sahara Tahoe opened. It opened as the largest casino in the world. And at the time, I was still going to college, and I started at the beginning of summer. And when winter came, of course, the business went down during the weekdays, and they were real happy to let me off a day a week. And so I dealt Fridays through Mondays, drove back sometimes through terrible snowstorms to San Francisco, to the University of California in San Francisco, and went to school on Tuesdays and Thursdays. And when I graduated, I kept up the same program with the University of Nevada, Reno, in their graduate school.
What were you studying in college? Was it related?
Social psychology.
After you graduated from college, did you go right back to work in the casinos full time?
Well, see, I was going, I worked the last 3 years of my undergraduate and graduate time. I worked 4 days a week in the casinos during the winter. And then during the summer, they worked me 6 days a week because they were so busy.
So you know that casino business from the bottom up, sounds like.
Now, you started out as a dealer, but so you stayed as a dealer then even for 3-4 years? You didn't move into being a pit boss?
No, what happened, I actually started as a shill. The year before, the summer before, I always was fascinated with gaming. I wanted to become a dealer and went to Vegas, but you had to have a lot of training to get into Vegas. And they made me a shill at the Fremont Hotel, minimum wage, $1 an hour. They had 40 shills there because when a gambler walks into a casino, they want to see a lot of action. In the evenings, we had 40 dealers there, so in the dinner hours and during the show hours, there could be up to 40 of us. We'd all be playing house money, and we all had black slacks and white shirts with a black tie in our pocket, and if a dealer didn't show up, we hoped to get our break at the tables. And I worked there for the summer, and then I went and dealt for 3 years at the Sahara Tahoe. The guys behind me, I tried every night when I got off work to get one of these guys from the illegal gambling backgrounds to go have a late night toddy, and I'd sit like a little kid listening to their stories. They were the most independent and toughest people I ever met in my life. And as I'd sit and listen, all the research I did, I have very simple concepts, but it took me a long time to understand these men and their culture. And they talked to me about police protection. And over time, as I listened to them, I realized, yes, they bribed the police to leave them alone with their illegal casinos, but they got no police protection. If someone robbed them, if someone tried to take over, if someone tried to take their territory, they couldn't call 911. They had an illegal business. So they had to defend themselves. Most of the guys I knew, somewhere along the line, they got knifed, they got shot. As I said, they were real tough men, but most of them had hearts of gold. I was fascinated with them and wanted to learn more about them, but I couldn't work and do the research. I started going to the University of Reno Library and starting to read about the various things I was interested in, but realized there was too much material. The Vietnam War came along. I was one of the first people drafted, and I declared as a conscientious objector. And they, by law, had to have the FBI do an investigation of everybody that knew me to find out what my religious beliefs were. And when they turned in their report, this was when J. Edgar Hoover was head of the FBI. He denied to Congress every year of his 48 years that there was no organized crime in America. There was no mafia, so the FBI knew nothing about gangland. They were absolutely amazed because I was hanging out with all these people in organized crime. So the Selective Service System said, "You are a most unusual person. You've never committed a crime, and yet you live among these people. Normally, when you are drafted as a conscientious objector, we put you 2 years in a hospital near your home, and you clean bedpans for 2 years because we don't want you to benefit from this designation." And they said, "In your case, we're giving you an option because with your social psychology background, your knowledge of the gaming industry, and being possibly the only outsider that's really gotten in with these people, we will draft you, and for 2 years you will work for the University of California, Berkeley School of Criminology, and you will hang out with gangsters in Las Vegas and learn how organized crime developed, how it operates, and for the first time, someone from the inside can put it together." So they gave me the choice. I thought, you know, hanging out with gangsters sounds better than cleaning bedpans. So I was off for 2 years, and I thought I'd really crack this thing in a two-year period of time. Well, I've ended up since reading 157,000 old newspapers, going through over 200,000 pages of FBI records. But the toughest part, even though over many years I interviewed almost 600 of the pioneers in the Nevada casino industry, many of them from organized crime, I thought if I got in with a few of them, they'd tell me the whole story. And what I didn't anticipate is all of these guys came out of Prohibition, and that was from 1920 to 1934. Then from 1934 to 1950, the four biggest gangs in Prohibition opened up illegal casinos across America, wide open to the public like today. They were fronted by the finest nightclubs, the finest restaurants in their areas. They ran these casinos until they went on to build the Las Vegas Strip. And I thought that if I knew a few, I could learn them all. Well, it turns out that in Prohibition, they became the most tight-lipped men I've ever encountered. They not only never talked to anybody but their close associates, but they didn't even tell their close associates anything that their associates weren't involved in, even legal businesses. I got in several arguments, and of course, I was not trying to win a point. I backed down immediately, where I'd be with one guy and I'd be talking about his lifelong partner, and I'd say, by the way, you know this business? He said, he never had that business. Well, I not only had documents, I'd already talked to the guy. I said, oh, okay, I got made a mistake here. They didn't tell anyone anything, so I had to get to every single one individually, and that's why I've spent 48 years at it before I started publishing the books about it.
So you started gathering for this book, 30 illegal years to the strip, you started gathering that documentation.
1967.
Information back then in 67. Yeah, interesting. So let's, we talked earlier, Bill, I'd like to focus a little bit on Frank Costello, and I say that because when I first started doing my own research on the mob influence out of Kansas City over Las Vegas, they really, their big influence was over the Tropicana. So when I'm researching the Tropicana, and I find this interesting little story about Frank Costello being shot and then found with a piece of paper in his pocket that indicated he was getting skimmed from the Tropicana in back end. Do you remember the year, I would say 1958 or 59?
Yeah, I don't remember the year, but that was exactly the time period it would have been in.
So, Frank Costello, talk a little bit about your research on Frank in running illegal gambling games. And we talked about this also, that a lot of those games were always out in the county, and they were in the backs of country clubs, and some of the finest people in the area would go to these games.
I'm happy to do that, but can we step back and take 3 minutes to talk about the three biggest gangs? Because you can't understand Costello unless you understand who he was involved with.
Okay.
Is that okay?
Yeah, that's great.
Okay. What we had, there was three gangs that totally dominated in Prohibition, and they weren't involved in one was involved with moonshine in the Midwest, but the other two were based in Manhattan, where over half the wealth of the country lived. These guys supplied the finest liquors of the world, and they were bringing in enormous quantities. We're talking about huge operations. All these guys came from poor neighborhoods. I never did learn how they financed all the freighter fleets, and from there the high-speed boats that took them in at the loaded up at night to come across the territorial waterline, and then the truck convoys that went across America. But the federal government, because they were buying the liquor legally, found out that Costello's gang, who was number two, was purchasing a minimum of 40 million bottles a year. It could have been much higher. I mean, we're talking about bringing in a staggering amount of liquor. The number one gang was headed by five people: Charlie Luciano, Meyer Lansky, Ben Siegel, Joe Adonis, and a man the public doesn't know. His name is Vincent Allo. I was very close to him. Everybody knew him by the name Jimmy Blue Eyes. I don't know one person who knew his real name. He was the closest friend of Charlie Luciano and the closest friend of Meyer Lansky and his lifelong partner in their casino operations. And then the last one was a man named Mo Dalitz in the Midwest, and he built the first great high-rolling casino in Vegas and also the world's biggest hotel at the time. And so these seven men, they partnered together in their casinos. They partnered together in legal liquor after Prohibition. You can't deal with one of them without the dealing with the other ones. And these seven men were businessmen. They were gamblers, and gamblers are different from everybody else in organized crime. And that's why I could relate to them, because I can't relate to anybody that hurts anybody. Gamblers, like everybody in organized crime, want your money, but they want to do it without hurting you. So they're a whole different value system. So these guys, they totally hated violence, preached against it. They said there's enough for everybody. Why are we killing each other? They totally rejected vendetta. They said this is crazy. An eye for an eye just makes the whole world blind. They totally opposed monopoly. These were the basic precepts of organized crime and the mafia. When the FBI for years had a list of what they called the open cities, and this list was cities in which any gang could operate, no one could claim territory, and they couldn't fight over it. Every one of these cities was either opened by Meyer Lansky or Ben Siegel by paying off the police, the prosecutors, and the judges for one crime and one crime only, and that was illegal casinos. And then they had territorial rights, and they could have kept everyone out, not with violence, just saying, if you come in, we're going to have you arrested and closed down. We have the police. Instead, they called every gang in the country and said, you all come in.
Bill, when you mentioned these particular names, I noticed that several of them are not Italian. And if I remember right, there was the 20s to the 30s up to Prohibition, it was primarily the old Mustache Pete's, and then there was kind of an upheaval in New York particularly. I think they called it they killed a bunch of the old Mustache Pete's off, and some of these younger guys like Lucky Luciano and Costello, and actually Al Capone was in Chicago at the time, but they started moving into prominence during the Prohibition, and they did it. They kept their La Cosa Nostra Italian-based or Sicilian-based crime families, but they joined in with these Jewish guys like Meyer Lansky and Ben Siegel and Mo Dalitz to then form a criminal syndicate, and that primarily operated with bootlegging, but then they moved into gambling is what I hear you saying. Would that be correct?
The gangs came out of very poor neighborhoods, and it was always the most recent immigrants. They banded together in their own neighborhoods, and this was true of all groups. It's not like one group can be singled out. So in any neighborhood, you would have a gang of a single nationality, and every gang in the country had a single nationality in it, except for four. The three we're talking about and the Al Capone gang, and they had multiple nationalities in their leaderships and in their membership. And as you said, the mafia at time Prohibition started had only Sicilians in it, the American mafia. There was nothing but Sicilians in it. They really didn't even want to deal with mainland Italians. When Prohibition ended, these groups all remained in their own neighborhoods. The three groups we're talking about, the big groups, They knew how to get along with everybody, how to deal with everybody. They were very sophisticated. They went out with the top socialites in the country. They became top people in politics. They were the ones that built the casinos across the country, because they can go into with any cultural group. They could go into any area. They knew how to talk to people and deal with them. And so they were the ones that totally spread across America. And it was because of this incredible ability to get along. So of the seven men we're talking about, you're talking about Luciano. He was the only Sicilian. And when they got into this war and they were drug in, they didn't want to be in. And then a second war occurred and they won both of them. And now all of a sudden, Luciano is made the boss of bosses of all of the Sicilian mafia. And they hated all of this stuff. The first thing he did, he knew if he rejected it, someone else would get it. And they always in Manhattan to operate had to pay the largest gang a percentage of their income to have a free reign in that territory. He cut out all payments. He took away the first meeting, all the powers of the boss of bosses. He said, everybody's on their own. We only meet to discuss problems of mutual interest and to stop gang wars like we've just gone through. Nobody can tell anybody else what to do. They got along with everyone, so you now had in this gang, the biggest mafia gang in the country, based in New York City, Luciano at the top.
Well, this was the background where these are the gentlemen then that had basically control of illegal gambling in markets all over the United States. And so then they meet in Vegas and Nevada are changing the laws to allow for legal gaming.
And they had no interest in Nevada until 1950. Only Ben Siegel came out in 47 with the Flamingo. Meyer Lansky beat him. The place was delayed, but he got involved with Thunderbird, which opened after the Flamingo. The rest were totally uninterested until the Kefauver Commission came along, Senator Kefauver, and they claimed that they were going after organized crime, but they really focused on gambling because it was open and obvious, and the rest of the crime they didn't know about. The public had supported the casinos because most of them were in small cities near large ones, and the local population benefited. You see in movies where gangs will come in and force their way and all this. Never happened in the history of America. No gang ever pushed themselves in. Our laws are strong enough to stop organized crime if you have honest police, honest politicians, and honest judges. So they'd come in and they'd bribe them. And the public liked it in these small towns because each one was near a large city. The wealthy people came in. These casinos were far more elegant than anything in Las Vegas today. They were absolutely fabulous places with the best food in the area, the finest entertainers. Some of them required tuxedos. Men couldn't come in without them. You can imagine how their wives were adorned for the evening. The locals absolutely loved it. One, it was bringing in all this tourism from the big city to the businesses. They were buying all their food and beverage from the farmers and ranchers and wholesalers locally. They were employing the locals as dealers, which were very good jobs with big tips. So they were really loved by the people. Then the Kefauver Committee got the gamblers to start talking and the police and the sheriffs in various parts of the country to admit they were taking bribes. The public loved the casinos, but they didn't like the corruption. And the federal government has never had laws against casinos, but the local population started voting them out everywhere in the whole country but Hot Springs, Arkansas, which only had tiny casinos. But they didn't put anybody in jail, hardly at all. When they'd have trials for the corrupt politicians, the juries would nullify it because they'd wanted it until they found out about the corruption. So very few people went to jail, but they closed the country down. Well, when they did that, you had wealthy men all over the country who wanted to gamble without any options. So now these guys all move into Vegas, and for the 2 decades from 1946 with the opening of the Flamingo until the opening of Caesar's Palace in 1966, this group of 7 men or their close associates built 80% of the hotels on the Las Vegas Strip. They also went into Havana, and those were the 2 big gambling centers because there now was no other outlet.
Well, that's interesting, you know, and you know, in Kansas City, we had something parallel just like what you're talking about in Platte County, which is just north of the river and outside the city limits at the time. And starting in the 30s, we had a place called the Cuban Gardens, which was owned and operated by the local mob boss, Johnny Lazia. And it was a high-end club that had tuxedoed waiters and fancy waitresses and cleanup staff and car parkers and people from the city. And they had a casino in the back room also. And then just down the road, about a mile, they had a horse race track, which Tom Pendergast, our local Richard Daley of Kansas City, our political boss, went to the racetrack. He was an addicted horse race gambler, and he would go up there all the time. And they had a kind of subterfuge. Horse racing in Missouri, the gambling on horse races wasn't legal, but they figured out a subterfuge that they could use in order to place a bet and then either win or lose. You know, all the way up until the 60s almost, we had a place called Mirror Lake Country Club, which was ran by a mob associate, a guy named Eddie Spitz Odishade. And he was really well-liked. I had an aunt that asked me one time. She knew that I was working organized crime when I was young. And she said, well, you ever heard of a man named Mr. Odishade? And I said, well, yeah, Eddie Spitz. And she kind of looked at me funny. And I said, yeah, he's like a mob associate gambler. And she said, well, he runs the Mirror Lake Country Club. He's just such a nice fellow. And so, you know, exactly what you're saying, I have seen right here in Kansas City. It's kind of a cultural phenomenon that we just blinked our eyes or winked our eyes at that for a while.
People have their addictions, be it gambling,
and sex, drugs, and rock and roll.
Yeah,
I
think they don't want to necessarily get anything in the way of that.
Yeah, really.
Certainly not the law.
Aaron was just talking about addiction and how strong it is and how powerful it is, and we don't really like anything to get in the way of our addiction. But yet there is, if addiction is causing you problems, if you are causing a friend or relative of yours problems, any kind of addiction, whether it be, as we say, sex, drugs, and rock and roll, whether it be gambling, drinking, drugs, you know, opioid addiction is a big deal right now. Why, make your first call to First Call, 816-361-5900. If you're from out of town, go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. They have a lot of good resources on that website.
And remember to... I believe Bill's book probably on Amazon, Bill Friedman, with
yes.
The book 30 Illegal Years to the Strip. And when we come back and the second segment, we're going to talk more with him. But also remember to subscribe to the podcast and share it as well. And tell your friends about it. And then also download the Kansas City Mob Tour app so that you can take a tour of known mob sites here in Kansas City. And after you're done doing that, make sure you put a hit out on our donate button, because Freedom Information Act requests are not free. And we've got more great shows lined up for you all year long, but we need your support to have it done.
We do. And one more thing, Aaron. I am going to develop some premium podcast, and some of them will be free, and some of them will be $1.99, and some of them will be 99 cents. We'll set an arbitrary figure on that because they're all valuable. We just want to figure out some way to get a little more help in here to keep this thing running.
Well, you've got that book you're working on, and
I'm
you just did that audio clip that you had people give me some feedback on. That audio clip, as your Kindle book will actually have audio from some of the wiretaps that you talk about in the book you're working on.
It will.
And I think I'd suggested we do a premium episode where we kind of dissect some of that audio.
And that audio, yeah, we'll do that.
Talk about what those guys are doing and play the clip.
And a good idea.
Discuss what they're saying and then share that with folks as a premium episode.
That's a good idea too, Aaron. I had a couple others, and that's the best one I've heard so far. All right. Good night, folks.
Good night. Music provided by Odd-O-Matic. Check them out at oddomaticmusic.com.